So, thanks to both Chris and Joan for inviting the three of us. It's just such a delight to read with Nancy and with Sam. I'm going to start just by saying a few words about Jimmy. As all many of you know, he was just such a wonderful encourager, and he just loved so many different kinds of poetry and supported so many different kinds of poets. And sometimes after I'd read, he'd say, I can't do his voice, but something like, "That was just like listening to T.S. Eliot." And he was just so generous. But it kind of made me wince a little bit, because one of my fears is that some of my poems seem a little too literary. And so what am I going to do tonight? I'm going to read a set of poems that all have a strong literary valence. And so all I can say is, Jimmy, this one's for you. And to keep you all engaged through that, I promise that one of the poems is going to be one of the most beautiful poems in the English language. I'm also going to read three new poems that really kind of celebrate regular people just trying to make beauty or a kind of poetry out of their own lives. And Jimmy, that's for you too. So this first poem is written for a poet that many of you know personally, Peter Oreszek, who died in 2016 of brain cancer. And he was an exceptional poet. He was an editor. He edited a couple volumes of poetry by working class writers, one of them called Working Classics. He was a wonderful person and friend and poet. He was also an activist. He protested nuclear proliferation with Molly Rush and Daniel Berrigan. He had this incredible work ethic. He made me think of this character in Upton Sinclair's novel called the novel's The Jungle, but the character was Jurgis. And anything t something terrible would happen to Jurgis, and he'd say, "I will work harder." Anyhow, well, late in life, Peter, of course, was not only a wonderful poet, he was a very, very good icon painter. And he started doing traditional paintings of saints. But toward the end of his life, he did a series of Russian writers, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. And importantly, for the purposes of this poem that I'm going to read, Chekhov as well. And this poem moves kind of between Peter and Chekhov, and I'll just sort of lean one way and lean the other as they go from one to the other. So this is called Peter Oreszek Cleans His Brushes After an Icon Painting Class. Spring comes late here in the run, your kind of Pittsburgh, rust-stained girders of the parkway high above, place of asphalt shingles, place of plastic-clad chain link, place of all those grayed, splayed houses, and of Jurgis's refrain, "I will work harder." Your work this waning afternoon? It's Chekhov with a golden nimbus, sober, impish, bald as a saint yourself from side effects. You stand rooted at the slop sink, part of any painter's work, part of your life of work, Carpatho-Russen family on the molten glasswork line, working classics, always poems. Now you wash the oils from sable brushes, thumbnail working at the ferrule's nickel plate, here at slant-crossed Onion Dome St. John Chrysostom, sorrow of its icons' silent song. Now the work of chemo, now firsthand you learn the mysteries of radiation, irradiant gold leaf, shook foil, shot through. Work of holding on and letting go. Chekhov, doctor, invalid, and craftsman, choir singer as a child, mushuk blood, a village grocer's son. I haven't a penny, but the way I reason, it isn't the man with a lot of money who is rich, but the one who can afford to be living now in the luxurious setting furnished by early spring. Finally, it's come, sudden with dandelions. Now, most democratic flower, they're everywhere, plush, persistent, sun-glazed after rain. For just a while, there's gold by the cinder block garages and the concrete stoops. Gold in the cracks of asphalt by the netless hoops. Beside the sidewalks, heaved up slab-like, like the working of a root. Gold among the tires tossed in vacant brushy lots, and by the rough-hewn stone foundation of your church. Chekhov, I do not believe in our intelligentsia. I believe in individuals, distinct personalities scattered here and there. But soon, they're gone. Weeded, poisoned, or transformed, a terrifying alchemy, to dried dark nubs, like brush heads left to stiffen, calcify. The tumor in your brain metastasize, stark black eye patch, almost blind. Yet, each day, you'd venture out, battered leather jacket, cane, your wife's supporting arm, moving through the seasons of your flowered yard, or among the slanting light and shadows of a city park, where, those weary final weeks, the locusts, oaks, and maples had just begun their work of turning to gold leaf. But now I see you by a glass block window, cleaning up with Chekhov. Small wood panel leaned against the sill. A floor above, a scattering of worshipers, candles flickering. A black-robed priest who stands before the icon screen to read Isaiah at the evening mass. Behold, he says, I am doing a new work. Now it shall spring forth. Chekhov. Prophet of the penal colony at Sakhalin. A writer is a man who has signed a contract with his conscience. At the end, fluted glass in hand, it's been a long time since I drank champagne. The dandelions? Impossibly they'll come again. Inverse of the dark atomic blooms that you and Rush and Berrigan protested, youthful, full of fire and prophecy. They come as ghostly halos, clouds of witnesses, generations dizzy on the wind, bright wisps unstoppable. And with each one arrives, tiny as an eyelash, difficult to see, the tough, dark brushstroke of a seed. This next poem is also a Pittsburgh poem. It's set in Squirrel Hill at Hanukkah, and it's called Down Syndrome Boy at the Movies. Down Syndrome Boy at the Movies. I saw the face of God today. He was wearing an olive-colored skullcap. Or maybe I saw the connection between them. His mother's arm draped loosely on his shoulders as they walked. The lamps of his doughy eyes burned only dimly, one chromosome tripled, as if Yahweh, insistent in his wish to take this frail, unlikely temple for his breath, should write the letter of his name three times. They were moving with purpose, already disappearing into the theater. I imagine that they liked the body-pummeled, stained red seats, the moment when the ghostly shaft of life, light suddenly divides the darkness. Also the suspense, they don't know how it ends. Although it's almost Hanukkah, the film portrays a close-knit band of street kids, not the Maccabees, but Palestinians. Some rocks, some blood. The crowd flows out subdued, though beneath the brightly lit marquee, A quiet scattering of talk begins, and gradually, small groups drift off to restaurants or home. But on the sidewalk, at the darkened edge of things, the boy is sobbing. His mother draws him close and kisses him. Again, again, she tastes the world's bitter salt. How, she wonders, does it end? I promise that one of this evening's, excuse me, one of this, I'm going to go for the water. Oops. So I promise that one of this evening's poems is going to be one of the most beautiful poems in the English language, and this is it. It's called Sailing to Byzantium, and it's by the Irish poet W.B. Yeats. It's a dense, very rich poem. So I'm going to give you a little preview, and it goes, you know, this is a wild paraphrase, but it goes kind of like this. Yeats says, well, you know, we're stuck in the natural world, and that's really good if you're young, but if you're old, it's maybe not so good. And if you're mortal and you're aging, well, all you can do is sing. And the best way to sing, to learn to sing, is to study the monuments of great art. So he imagines going to Byzantium and standing in front of the great gold mosaics of the saints. And while he's there, he kind of prays that he'll find his eternal form like beautiful singing birds that Grecian goldsmiths might make. So this poem is in four sections, Sailing to Byzantium by William Butler Yeats. One. That is no country for old men. The young in one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations at their song. The salmon falls, the mackerel crowded seas, fish, flesh, or fowl, commend all summer long whatever is begotten, born, and dies. Caught in that sensual music, all neglect monuments of unaging intellect. Two. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress. Nor is there singing school, but studying monuments of its own magnificence. And therefore, I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium. Three. O sages standing in God's holy fire, as in the gold mosaic of a wall, come from the holy fire, pern in a gyre, and be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away. Sick with desire and fastened to a dying animal, it knows not what it is. And gather me into the artifice of eternity. Four. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing. But such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make, of hammered gold and gold enameling, to keep a drowsy emperor awake, or set upon a golden bough to sing, to lords and ladies of Byzantium, of what is past, or passing, or to come. We can clap for that. Well, I love that poem, but I also want to quarrel with it. And you know how it goes with lovers' quarrels. It's sometimes sort of hard to say what really got it all started. You know, is it sort of the aristocratic quality feel of the poem? Is it the
kind of perfection, ideal of perfectionism in art that sort of seems to, you know, leave out everybody, all the rest of us, except the high, great high geniuses of art? Or is it the kind of escape to some ideal world and the idea of finding the holy elsewhere? Well, anyhow, Yeats got me thinking about my friend Setu Jones and his wife Soini, who created a beautiful park and farm in a low-income neighborhood called Frogtown in the city of St. Paul. And so, like Yeats's poem, this mine rhymes a lot, and it's also in four sections, so it's kind of an homage as well as a quarrel. So this is the last poem I'll read. It's called Thinking of a Friend, I Quarrel with Yeats and Stand in Holy Fire. And it starts with an epigraph that will be quite familiar to you right now. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing. W.B. Yeats. One. Laureled old man, Yeats longed to sail away, off to a land of artisans, of holy sages, emperors, and queens. He'd taught his soul to fly. Goodbye to all those once warm birds, enameled now, though singing still, transformed to gold machines. Two. Next to public housing, the boarded foundry, a fading 60s strip mall, mostly vacancies, but also home to Al-Ishan Islamic Center Mosque, Tashi's Rainbow Nails, Hmong Auto Shop, sits the 13-acre Frogtown Farm and Park, dreamed for years, Setu and Soini's latest art. Setu walks along the rows of collards, carrots, beans. He kneels beside a girl who pats a seedling in, helps set its wobbly leaf head with her trowel. She's the last one here, so Setu shows her how to fit the padlock on the greenhouse door. Outside, as dusk slants on, her grandma waits for her. It's getting late. Pale fingerprint of moon ascends above St. Paul. Setu walks alone. Perhaps he wonders if the art he grows will matter or endure. Already now, the rows are filling up with dark. The air turns chill, his weary body more and more invisible. Three. I sit, a graying man, nursing my coffee till it's gone. The windows in the old brown brick apartments opposite are blazing in late winter sun. All the lives that ever lived there held and lit. There's fire all around us. We stand in it. Charged, interwoven fields flow everywhere, unseen. I watch some students with their backpacks heading home. They're in middle school, and aren't we all deep in our changes and uncertainties? I gather my things to go, then cross the slushy grid-edge street. A moil of kids, three pass me now. Two boys in hooded sweatshirts, talking smack. A girl leans in, she's shy, but eager too. Close friends, it seems, the way they joke and jostle through, shaping each other. That's their work. Have they kissed? I watch them go, as jumpy and as musical as any salmon fowl and or mackerel crowded sea. Four. I imagine Setu at an overlook that he designed. Its path and railings echo, moving current, weeds. Above, an early hawk is soaring through wide sky. A nearby meadow whispers to the marsh to fill with silt. A brook, meanwhile, draws moisture from the marsh
to flow. God finds her only shape in all these natural things. And we contribute too, through our imaginings. All this sensual music, does it die entirely? Dogs bark, morning traffic hums beyond the public housing and the foundry. In fluent counterpoint, frog percussion, bird song, branchy wind, and insect chitter rise from the marshland and surrounding fields. Now sun breaks through the pines and catches the moving mist on fire. A current whispery and luminous. Thank you all so much.